Robin Conway on 26 November 73. So what were your main findings in your thesis?
So the attempt was to take the brightness distribution across the sun, several different frequencies, and use the theoretical work, particularly of SMERD, to try and investigate the electron density and electron temperature in the solar corona. Refinements of existing models were possible, but I wouldn't claim that was a very outstanding advance in solar physics. It was just some more data. as I say, the thing that really interested me coming out at the end of this was the subsidiary set of measurements on the spectrum of radio discrete sources. Things like Virgo A, Hercules A, 3C295, what one would class now as a moderately intense source. Radio spectrum of those is completely unknown to me.
But these are all extragalactic. You weren't interested in trying to do galactic sources?
No. Again, it was a question of technological limitations that I had an interferometer, and galactic sources, by and large, were resolved, and one didn't get the flux density off them. Also, things like H2 regions were being measured at high frequencies by single dish observers, particularly
at NRL.
NRL in America.
So, you got interested in these radio sources in the late 50s.
Right.
And
then I came here at the end of my time at Cambridge.
Leiden, yeah.
And I had 1.5 years in Leiden altogether. On arrival, I found that Seeger and Westerhout were just about to start a survey of the continuum background at 400 megahertz. And I assisted with this. And along the line, picked off from the coming map the intensities of some of about a dozen or two dozen sources, just to add to the radio spectrum findings.
What was the reason for coming here? I mean, it wasn't much to do with radio sources or the sun.
Should we say it was a bit more personal, that I wanted to get away from Cambridge. I had a feeling that Cambridge perhaps was a very nice place, but was a good place to get away from. And I asked Martin Weil what the possibilities were and tossed a phone, and it seemed indicated kind of like.
So you sort of accidentally got into background polarization because that was going on?
No, the background polarization in fact had not started here.
Oh, I see.
I helped construct a model number 2 receiver, which was the one eventually they did do the polarization work with, but I never used it myself.
I see. And when were you in Holland now? This is late
50? January 57 until June 58.
Okay, that was, well before the before it got started, And then when you went back, to Travel?
I went back because I wanted to get married and I wanted a job at the Division Pay Packet to get married. And in September, I went back to Cambridge, but, that was a slightly peculiar experience. It didn't seem to fit. And a job became available at Jodrell that Christmas, and I moved to Jodrell Christmas 1958, where I've been since, barring expected years.
And what did you work on at Jodrell?
When I got to Jodrell, I found that Hanbury Brown and Cyril Hazard were using the then new Mark 1 telescope on work on the spectrum of radio sources, so again it was indicated that I should join them. And we made some measurements first at 610 megahertz and then 408 and other similar frequencies. And the big break came in 1953 when an offer came from Bob Long at Cambridge and
1963.
Yeah, 5 years after I got to Jodrell. To put together measurements at many different frequencies, which became the paper Conway, Kellam, and Long.
Right. And let me just ask: these were not radio galaxies, even though this was Hanbury, Brown, and Hazard. But these were not the normal galaxies.
Hanbury, Brown, and Hazard were doing some work on normal galaxies, I guess I maybe just sort of strung along with them and put in some measurements of my own on. Yeah, just radio sources in general. I think at that stage we were still doing the picking up of information from any direction sort of activity, rather than a very carefully statistically selected set.
So the intensity of the source is more important, really, than the type of the source.
Yeah, the various technical limitations on a source that's above the intensity limit of working, and depending very much on its angular size, confusion, whatever else happens around it, and so on.
Okay, kind of like Hellman and Long, was a rather important paper, wouldn't you say? I mean, in terms of defining the spectra, for, it was the first time they'd really accurately been done, except for a few sources.
Right. The breakthrough, in fact, was to increase the wavelength coverage and see that there was a more or less common form for a very large number of sources.
Right. And before that, there had been, Cass and Cygnus and so forth.
And the other difficulty was that the calibration of sensitivity of different systems of different observatories was a difficult matter to get straight. And there was a period around about 1956 when it was thought that sources all showed markedly curved spectra. But when it looked as though all sources were going to show the same curvature, then became apparent that this was not really an effect, it was just a false calibration. But how to calibrate was a very difficult question.
But what was the nature of this curvature? I haven't heard about this.
I think it was a measurement by Nancy Ronan. I've forgotten what frequency, but in the some hundreds of megahertz, which did not agree with other measurements, shall we say, for weight.
Yeah.
And if you believed all of them at their face value, it would give
a hump
spectra
in the middle.
A hump and a dip.
Yeah, I see. Mm.
But, I mean, that was obviously a false trail, and it was fairly obvious fairly quickly that it was a false trail, but it was the sort of thing that was causing difficulty.
Yeah.
And our method was to say, we believe that, to best of our knowledge, Cass has straight spectrum. We will take that, define that as straight, and work from there. Well, that's not altogether the ideal procedure, because Cass, for one thing, varied with time, and so on, so you can refine on it, but in its day, it was a big advance.
That was discovered just before you began this program, I think, wasn't it, 62, or...? Right, Shakeshaft and
I don't remember the date. I wouldn't quarrel with you. At that stage, there had been again one or two false starts, and a report from Australia that Hydra A was a variable.
I remember that.
In a way, what was satisfactory was that if Cass was a variable, it was only a variable by 1% or so. So it was down within
you
the
tolerance to limits
of what we were working to. Yeah.
But Hydra, was that one of your sources that you were using?
It was one I'd measured along the line, and I'd never been able to see it vary. But then I had not made a systematic study looking for variability.
What ever came of that, by the way? I've seen that in literature. Has it ever been explained?
It's not
a variable, is it?
No.
Certainly not low frequencies.
No. I think probably the explanation would be scintillation or something like that.
So, the definition of the spectrum in a large sample of sources would seem to me was important for then the sort of the basic model which we still have today of what a radio source is. The Van der Waan and the Kellerman sort of ideas, because that was based on the spectrum. Or is that true? Was that known before then?
I think... already at that time, we had the distinction straight between thermal sources, which are a curved spectrum, and the non-thermal sources, most of which showed a straight spectrum.
Yeah.
What came later was the sources which had a straight, steep spectrum of low frequencies, and inverted at the high frequencies, a high-frequency bump. The importance of these, I think, really became important at the next stage, in 1966 or so, with the measurements of 273, 279, 454.3, and so on, by the NRAO group and the Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a few years later.
Yeah.
In fact, in 1966 to 1967, I had my first sabbatical year at NRAO, and on arrival I was given the news of this by the Haitians, a great and exciting new thing, that they had variable sources, which really did vary, on the time scale of months. In fact, come to think of it, no, NRAO was not the prime discoverer, it was Dent.
That's right.
Dent
3273.
And NRAO took up Dent's findings and prosecuted them.
That was the first extragalactic variable source.
Yes.
But, I guess I'm still not clear then. Was there a theoretical importance then for the CKL paper? Did anyone take it up and work with that, or just...
I think you could hardly describe it as a great theoretical breakthrough, because it was already known that most sources showed what synchrotron theory would predict, namely a simple power law. The importance was rather that here was a substantial collection of data, and it indeed seemed to have the expected property. If a property is expected, then of course it's not a new breakthrough.
Yeah.
On the other hand, to be a substantial body of data
right, when you extend
is important, the... even if it doesn't show up something that's new.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
In the next few years, what we were keen on doing was extending the lists. I don't know if it counts as an anecdote, it's somewhat technical, but we were bothered by the fact that at that time the Australians discovered that extragalactic sources did show linear polarization. That if one measured with a linearly polarized system, of course one might get the answer wrong.
when all you wanted was a flux spectrum.
That's right. Yeah, you'd get the integrated flux spectrum wrong.
Yeah.
You get errors in the flux density at any one frequency. So we said, well, what we wanted to measure both polarizations. And we came to grips with the fact that any one antenna, you can't put both polarizations down one receiver channel. You have to have two. but you can improve things if you take two dipoles at the focus and connect them in phase quadrature. And then what you get circular polarization. So we constructed circularly polarized feeds. And I said to Bob Long as we were doing it, what happens if we get one of these the wrong way around? Well, in fact, it was exactly what we did do. The first time we connected it up, we were in very good company. We had one of our hands of circular polarization different from... The hand of circular polarization in one telescope different from the hand of circular polarization in the other telescope in an interferometer pair. So we had to sit down with a piece of paper and say, what happens when you do this? And we worked out that with a correlation interferometer, you don't get the random because it's not correlated. You don't get the circular because it's in one or the other, but not both, but you do get the linear. And since then, we've used this deliberately as a method to measure polarization.
So that was just accidental.
So that was one of those serendipity, I think is what they call it.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's see now. Oh yes, the sample of sources in CKL, was that homogeneous in any sense?
Not strictly. It was a question of who measured what, and we all kicked in. There was an attempt to make a homogeneous sample within that, but it was pretty small. If I went to the file, I could try.
You mean it's in that paper?
I think it's in the paper.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was in subsequent work. Bob Long then did some subsequent work in increasing the number of sources measured at this sort of frequency, whereas I rather changed my interest and said, well, I want to go for polarization, I want to measure polarization. And we'd set up the interferometer consisting of the two big telescopes in Georgia Bay and found that this was a very good polarimeter, it was a very nice machine to work with, so we pressed on. In fact, we got the system going, I suppose, 64, 65.
Which one?
By the system.
Mark 1 and Mark 2.
Mark 1 and Mark 2 at Jordan Bank. A certain amount of my work was done with the Mark 2 at higher frequencies, 11 centimeters and 6 centimeters, and I left a graduate student behind when I went on my sabbatical leave. But I also left him behind with another supervisor, so I guess it could be said that I deputed that work over to somebody else.
Yeah.
And Ted Daintree and Dennis Walsh have been doing work along those lines more or less since then, measuring spectra of sources at the high frequencies and searching for other sources, so searching for new sources. The year I spent in America, I had a project which deliberately was trying to work on polarization, trying to measure the polarization distributions in sources, and we took a list of six bright sources to measure with the NRAO interferometer at 2695 megahertz. And
indeed, two elements then?
No, it was in fact three.
It was three.
I arrived to find the two element interferometer had just finished its useful life, and they were going to let it, they were going to take it down for refit and repair, And this was going to take just about all the time we had there. Fortunately, it didn't quite. We got some observations in, and I left some observations being done at the end. Of course, when you do this, there's one snag that the analysis that comes afterwards is hampered by the fact that one's moved away and is sitting at the wrong side of the Atlantic. So the maps of brightness distribution indeed have come out under the names of Hogg, McDonald, Conway and Wade, I think. The maps of polarization, on the other hand, have had to take a back seat. And one of the sources I cited was 3C273, which I published under my own name, rather than with the Greenberg team. But that just was a consequence of this fact that sabbatical years are like that.
Yeah, I'm going to run into that myself very shortly. If I go back to CKL, so you say that the sample was more or less picked on what was available, what were the bright sources and what had been.
I think we realized at the time that we'd better publish what we've got, and any questions of tidying up the statistical loose ends could be left for further work, and this is more or less what's happened. The people have added to it, and of course they've improved CKL because it was an early shot and the observations can be considerably improved, and for example, there's a Kellerman.
But my question is, was it somewhat serendipitous again that that the spectra all did come out to be similar power law spectra, even though it was such a variety?
Yes, of I would say that what we were each of us doing, of course, was working on source lists that came from the low frequencies. There were 3C sources or what have you. And if you work on sources picked by the low frequencies, then they're more bound to this deep spectra. So what we missed were the flat spectrum sources.
Right.
And
okay, that's true. That tended to homogenize your, so to speak, your sample. That's right.
Yeah. Who would it be? Was it the Australians? Who would it be? Dent.
For what?
That pointed out that there was an important population of flat spectrum sources, which is not in the low frequency family.
I think Dent. Yeah. I'm not sure.
And of course, these have become a very important part of our study of quasars.
Right. Let me just ask about polarization. Was that Centaurus was the first extragalactic source picked up with polarization?
Certainly, is the first one whose polarization was studied in any detail. Yes.
Yeah. I just wanted, and that was Gardner and White Oak. Is that correct?
Well, certainly Australian. Whether in fact it's those two names are attached to Centaurus, I don't know. But Gardner and White Oak, and of course the important series of papers by Maurice Gardner and White Oak.
Yeah. Okay, well, that brings me up until the point, like I told you earlier, where I think it just begins to get out of hand a bit much.
Too much
like some of the data here still isn't published, so that shows me I've gone too far. Unless you have something else that you would like to add.
That ends the interview with Robin Conway on 26 November 73.